Good morning. I'm deeply honored to speak with you about what and who have sustained my voice, fueled me through these many years. I'll tell this story in three parts. Part one, activism, justice, and personal background. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister and statesman, wrote, quote, "Sir, I say that justice is truth in action," unquote. The making of justice consists of all manner of complex parts and players. How do we move all parts of the U.S. government towards fairer, more just human rights to put truth in action and actually change laws? Mainly, we create social movements. And within social movements, there are interest groups, such as Service Members Legal Defense Network, which I served for many years, including as a founding board member. And within interest groups, the individual activist comes alive with passion and acts towards changing policies and laws. Social movements, interest groups, and activists. I see one right there, Dot. Today we'll be addressing the activist, the player who lifts up his voice or her voice towards bringing about social change. Howard Thurman, an influential theologian and civil rights leader, once said, quote, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive," unquote. I've served with many activists, working to change laws for military women in the 1970s, and then for military gays in the last 5 years or more. My simple answer as to what drives an activist is a matter of nature and nurture. Those innate personal attributes and life experiences that sustain one through the journey, a journey that is sometimes painful, yet always deeply fulfilling. One of my key sources of strength is my UU faith. But my own life journey did not lead me to a UU congregation till I was 57. I'll now describe the dramatic contrast between how I felt about myself and my sexual orientation during my first 42 years of strong Navy roots versus my last 30 years after coming out and being supported emotionally by partners, friends, family, and later, my spiritual community. And very importantly, by the truth, as learned through life experiences. My life cruise, spanning many American states and waters, has oftentimes been rolling with low visibility. My parents in my corner of the world were intolerant of who I sensed I might be. My intuition about my sexuality was felt but not acknowledged. Once I acted out these feelings, I lived a lie. My father was a career naval officer, and I felt predestined to a Navy career. In 1960, I entered the Navy and fell in love with it, and with another officer, a woman. The Navy was just right. So, too, was the officer, who eventually became my partner of several years. To this day, she is one of my best friends. Although I fought against it, falling in love with a woman was surprisingly natural. Being as clueless about homosexuality as most Americans were in the 1960s, I certainly did not give much thought to self-identifying as a queer, as my mother referred to homosexuals back then. I was terribly confused. Given what Americans and my family and friends in the United States Navy thought about homosexuals, how could I love another woman? My emotional and physical selves, however, informed me that I was fortunate, one, to have discovered who my sexual being was, and two, to find my soulmate. For several years, I was torn. The Navy's rules and regulations stated I should resign if I were sexually involved with a person of the same sex. Yet I remained blissfully in love with a special woman. To assuage the dilemma, I dated several male naval officers, many, hoping against reality I might be bisexual and meet society's heterosexist precept. For my partner, who had already come to her own decision about her sexuality, The dating game was clearly a raw deal. In 1971 or so, I finally resolved that I was not bisexual, turning down a marriage proposal. I drew comfort from my conscience, knowing that to marry a man, however wonderful he might be as a husband, would have been unfair to the man, my family, and me. No matter whether my country, my Navy, my family, or my fellow officers felt my sexuality was abnormal or wrong, I needed to be me. I relied upon the strength of my own character, my family upbringing, and the moral ethics that church, I was a Protestant and Episcopalian for quite a while, and my beloved Wellesley had instilled in me. My choice not to marry was right. Just before my mother's death at age 95, I told her that her greatest gift to her three children was the gift of self-esteem, which had carried me through some turbulent, self-searching times. Today's changes in societal norms about sexual orientation, as well as my own UU spiritual path and UU friendships, would have greatly helped me work through many difficult decisions. Life would have been less agonizing and less lonely. Part 2, Consciousness Raising, Two Big Clicks and a Memoir. Beyond the struggle of learning to live as a closeted lesbian in the military, another storm brewed. Despite challenging, exciting assignments and an outstanding professional record and reputation, my love for the Navy was lessening. In 1965, as the top-rated officer of 37 naval officers graduating from American University's School of International Service Master's Program, for the first time, I felt the sting of discrimination. Instead of getting my choice of orders to teach at the Naval Academy, or to work in the Pentagon's Political Military Affairs Office, possible billets offered to the top students in the class, the Navy ordered me to a mediocre job. This decision was purely because of my gender. I experienced what psychologists call a felt need. My experience is what Jane Riley later labeled as the click, an awakening of feminist consciousness. Riley's article, some of you may have read it, some of you women, The Housewife's Moment of Truth, appeared in the premier issue of Ms. Magazine in 1971. At that moment of experiencing denial and gender discrimination in 1965, I knew I would do something about changing the Navy's policies towards women. In the late 60s and early 70s, I was engaged in a demanding assignment at the Naval War College, Newport, Rhode Island, as well as an after-hours project that would help rectify the lack of opportunities offered to Navy women. I had been tapped by the Chief of Naval Personnel to author a study that would become a benchmark regarding the status of military women and a conceptual framework for opening up military women's opportunities as directed by the Secretary of Defense. To be an outspoken feminist was unacceptable behavior to most members of our Navy, both male and female. Nonetheless, something about speaking up for those women who were more silent, more junior, more threatened, and less cerebral motivated me to take to the library and analyze and present a solid case for Navy women's equality to the admirals. I recommended that a comprehensive study be initiated which reformulated, quote, the raison d'etre of women in the Navy in light of recent changes in society and in the Navy, unquote. And under the leadership of the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Bud Zumwalt, that's exactly what occurred. Today, Navy women have achieved stellar heights, heights unforeseen by me and other Navy waves of yesteryear. In retrospect, our UU principles, unconsciously embedded within my soul, had encouraged me to work long hours and put up with being called the Navy's, quote, flaming radical women's liber, unquote, by my male counterparts of all ranks. The work was about the inherent worth and dignity of every person, our first principle, and justice and equity and compassion and human relations, our second principle. It was also about seeking the truth, condoning or forgiving the Navy's unjust personnel policies towards its women was not my style. Later on in my career, I became one of the Navy's first women commanding officers. The primary personal obstacle to creating an inclusive atmosphere within the command, however, was not lack of human resources or expertise, but rather my own sexual orientation. During the 2.5-year command tour, I discharged at least 8 young men and women for, quote, cause of homosexuality, unquote. Each discharge tore at my heart. I was sending home young, competent sailors again and again. Then, almost 2 years into the assignment, a stunning event occurred. I learned that my commander, suspicious of my living with 2 other women, wished to force me out of command. He had put a tail on me for several weeks to prove his suspicion. Fear and a sense of betrayal rushed through me. After this breach of trust, the next discharge of 2 young lesbians was a pivotal turning point, a second type of click. One might say this started the awakening of my own LGBT consciousness, or moment of truth. My integrity was screaming at me. I had come out to my parents the year before. When I told Dad that I was contemplating early resignation or retirement, even though knowing my sexual orientation, he counseled me to stay in the Navy. "You'll make Captain Beth, and who knows, perhaps you'll be our first Lady Admiral." To know me is to know that I wanted to make captain. Since my father was an admiral, I should at least be a captain, I thought. My assignment officer told me he was sending me to the Pentagon to a captain's billet, and he expected me to be selected at the next selection board. What to do? My deepest roots from birth were my family and the United States Navy. After 21 years of having to hide my sexual orientation, I felt I had little choice but to cut myself off from my Navy roots, submit my retirement papers, and find other fertile soil in which to plant roots. In order to maintain my integrity, I needed to say goodbye to a professional relationship with the United States Navy. No longer could I live a lie. No longer could I cope with the sword of Damocles hanging over my head. I retired on 1 September 1980 without making captain. In the post-Navy years, I began to feel as though I were a free American citizen. I could fly, I could speak, I could seek, I could cry, I could be me. But I missed the Navy in those deep roots. With 1993 came a major political fight over gays in the military, as most of you in this room recall. And another unstoppable felt need rose up from within to document my work for Navy women's equality and at the same time write about the injustices of my gay experiences in the military. After 4 years of working with 6 other authors, including Esther, a creative memoir, My Navy 2, was ready for publication. 2 contentious issues interfered. First, my father, now retired admiral. Dad said, quote, "There are many books in the library, Beth, but this should not be one of them." "You're a fine thinker. Write about the United Nations or Sino-Soviet relations, but do not write about this subject," unquote. He knew that publication would not only out me, but also him and mother. The second issue was use of my name as the primary author. Navy experts had advised me it was unclear whether military retirees were subject to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. My pension and benefits might be jeopardized. After long discussions, my father and I settled our differences. And at the end of our debates, there were quite a few of them, Dad said, "Beth, you didn't have any choice, did you?" No. Resolution about the use of my name on the cover came in my former UU minister's office at First Church, San Diego. Reverend Tom Owentowell and I had worked in the peace movement together. I trusted Tom's judgment. After explaining my dilemma about using my real name, Tom looked me straight in the eyes and said, "Take courage, Beth." I knew what he was saying. My parents had given me the courage to be myself, whereas Tom's support gave me that second wing to set me free, free from fear and paranoia, which I had sustained while on active duty. In the years to follow, the more I spoke my truth about my sexual orientation, the freer I became. As I think about it, Tom had counseled me to stand on the side of love. My Navy, too, has my name on the cover. In later years, I would learn that retirees are not subject to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but in 1997, it felt like a huge risk to publish a book that once again confronted the entity I call Big Daddy Navy and its underlying value system and regulations. I remembered what Mother often said to her children, to live without risk is not to live at all. Sharing. Now we move on to the part three, our UU Faith and Justice, repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In 1995, I joined RUF and have had no regrets about my full commitment to UUism and to my own religious community. I've felt fully supported by fellow RUFians, you, in my work to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. UUs, along with partners, friends, and family members, especially my mother, have strengthened my courage to speak candidly. The angst and disappointment of retiring early from my Navy, too, have been superseded by the love and warmth of being among UUs who understand LGBT concerns and who are proactively working to take strategic social actions. As many of you know, I have taken my faith, my patriotism, and activism into the wider world by speaking out and writing about repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell at both the local and national levels. Many years ago, I learned the pen can be as powerful as the sword, though the writer must be prepared to receive wounds just as soldiers and sailors do on the battlefield and in enemy waters. Indeed, one endures a form of combat in responding to the attacks to justice, freedom, and equality across the nation's radio waves, in the halls of Congress, or on cyberspace's websites. So when internet posters attacked me personally with bitterness and ugliness, I thought of my UU friends, as well as my fellow gay veterans who emboldened me to stand up and be counted. Over the past 40 years, I've revealed my sexual orientation to many straight friends and family members. What I know from these discussions is that depending upon one's upbringing, age, sex, religion, education, and color, a majority of Americans are gradually taking off their heterosexist filters, recognizing that friends and family members who happen to have been born non-heterosexual are really okay and are just like themselves in every other way. Thanks, Eileen. Thanks. My own filters regarding homosexuality have changed dramatically over the years. Not until stepping away from Plato's metaphoric cave, in my case, the military subculture, so secretive and edgy about homosexuality, did I become more comfortable and accept myself as different from 95% or so of the rest of our culture. For me, the moral courage to fight for Navy women, juxtaposed with living a lie as a closeted military lesbian for 20 years, flowed from many sources. At the top of my list has to be the love and full support from my parents. And there's my first cousin right over there, Kay. Her dad and my dad were brothers. Other sources of strength include love of my country, a solid liberal education, overriding internal values of justice and freedom for all, and love from partners, friends, and other family members, and later my UU faith. Activists are people who need people in a big way. We gay and lesbian veterans who fought years for Don't Ask, Don't Tell's repeal worked as a team, with rank or rating often not a factor as to assumption of leadership. At times we felt truly like outsiders removed from our beloved military. In emails, we often quoted military or political leaders or used the language of our military subculture to cheer ourselves on. We who came from the naval branches would shout out, "Bravo Zulus," well done, to our fellow activists who had scored in some way towards achieving our goal. We vowed to each other, especially in the hard times, and there were quite a few, to never give in, never give in, never never, never, never. Words said by Winston Churchill on October 29th, 1941, to the Harrow School. We had the faith that if we just kept doing the work every day, the truth would win out. Last October, our Social Justice and Action Committee played a key role in orchestrating the first Southern Oregon Pride Weekend, including a special parade down Ashland's Main Street. Most of you recall that we had two floats with two UU ministers, including Reverend Leslie, officiating in lesbian and gay weddings. I sat in the cab of the first truck waving to the crowds that lined Main Street. Below my open window hung a poster with my name, rank, and service, and the symbol for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I was overcome with joy and amazement to see families, straights and gays, students, people of color, all waving back to me, cheering and clapping for marriage equality and repeal of the military ban on gays. Straight allies marched down hometown street with open members of the gay community, including me. That was something I had never dreamed could happen in my lifetime, the impossible dream. Later in the year, Saturday morning, 18 December 2010, to be exact, I woke up at 5:45 a.m. with great anticipation, knowing the Senate would take a cloture vote on repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. An hour later, I listened to our Senator Ron Wyden speak with great passion from the Senate floor, telling his colleagues, quote, "I don't care who you love. If you love your country enough to risk your life, you shouldn't have to hide who you are," unquote. After many more speakers, pros and cons, a vote to end debate took place. We won, with 63 voting in favor of cloture. After the cloture vote, Senator Wyden called me. The call was emotional for both of us. I cried. He told me how important repeal was for all Americans. Several friends and I watched the final vote, 65-31, with 8 Republicans voting yes. We watched together, filled champagne glasses in hand, tears streaming. Our time had come. This past Friday, as we've said, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the President certified that lifting the gay ban will not hurt the military's ability to fight, which we already knew. 60 days from this certification, 20 September, will be the ultimate death of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In summary, my deep Navy roots were torn asunder 40 years ago, but today other roots hold me close, especially those I've grown as a UU, practicing engaged spirituality. Love and support from family and friends, Reverend Tom Owenthal's wisdom and encouragement, and love and support from my longtime companion and Wellesley classmate, Esther, of over 30 years, together entrusted me with wings that set me free. I now am able to close the chapter of 50 years of my life and truly feel it's my Navy too. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for down deep, there is another truth. You are not alone. Thank you, all of you. I salute you. Together we are all family.